Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 99, Light Bright, where I bring you the history of light-emitting diodes through the 1980s and 1990s. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. Back in episode 78, I brought you the early history of light-emitting diodes, or LEDs for short, up through the 1970s, where their characteristic red digits invaded alarm clocks, digital instrument readouts, wristwatches, and calculators, and soon thereafter, amber and yellow-green LEDs were popular as status indicator lamps in electronic apparatus. But shortcomings of LEDs in those days were twofold. First, they weren't bright enough for serious illumination, and second, they didn't exist in blue. So RCA's dream of a flat-color television to hang on a wall never came true at the time. That didn't mean scientists gave up on LEDs, though. Let's see first how efficiency and brightness of LEDs increased through the 1980s and 1990s. There were new techniques to fabricate LEDs starting in the 1970s. These were two methods, molecular beam epitaxy and metal organic vapor phase epitaxy, which at heart go back to surface chemistry on semiconductors. In molecular beam epitaxy, you heat up some semiconductor surface in a vacuum and direct atoms to settle on that surface layer by layer, forming a nice organized structure. The original idea came about in 1958, but was refined over the next couple of decades until it became practical for optical engineering in the mid-1980s. For metal organic vapor phase epitaxy, you shoot whole molecules, which are reactants, at your hot semiconductor surface. The molecules react and deposit the important elements you want onto the surface, and the byproducts are whisked away. For example, one common precursor reactant is phosphine, that nasty toxic pH3 molecule about which I said in the previous episode, if you smell it, you're dead. The hydrogen atoms leave, and phosphorus atoms are deposited on your semiconductor surface. Typically, these two techniques were used to carefully build so-called 3-5 materials. This is a shorthand way of saying a material made of one or more group 3 elements plus one or more group 5 elements in the periodic table. An example would be gallium arsenide, because gallium is in the group 3 column and arsenic is in the group 5 column. But there is a caveat here. You just can't grow anything on top of any other thing and have it stick properly, or if it sticks, work properly. At minimum, you need to adjust things so that the spacing between atoms in the bottom material, the substrate, is reasonably similar to the spacing between atoms in the top layer you are trying to grow. If they are very different, you have what's called lattice mismatch. The upper layer atoms just can't grab on properly to the underlying material, and you might get random arrays or junk, or what specialists call defects in the crystal structure. Much of semiconductor research in the 1970s and 1980s was devoted to finding the sweet spot of lattice growth between two dissimilar materials at various temperatures. Some thought, perhaps, instead of a group 3-5 material, maybe a 2-6 material would work. As you can guess, this requires a group 2 element, in this case zinc metal, plus a group 6 element, here selenium. you can grow zinc selenide pretty well on gallium arsenide with only a 0.3% difference in distances between atoms from one material to the next. This gave a density of defects below 1,000 per square centimeter, which was considered decent enough to make LEDs. By the mid-1980s, a new semiconductor material, gallium aluminum arsenic phosphide, had greater brightness than previous LEDs, up to 1 to 2 lumens per watt. This is a 3-5 compound because both gallium and aluminum are group 3, and arsenic and phosphorus are group 5. These LEDs glowed at around 660 nanometers, which is a similar color to the helium neon laser red. In 1987, Hewlett-Packard began offering their LEDs for use in car brake lights and traffic lights, so finally these LEDs were of comparable brightness to incandescent bulbs. Over the course of the 1990s, they began to displace old filament-based bulbs in red taillights because they lasted thousands and thousands of hours and were far more efficient using much less electricity. During these decades, similar yellow and green LEDs were produced. So Hewlett-Packard was able to fabricate gallium phosphide into super bright green LEDs by 1993, so now we could have the green color of traffic lights included. Soon thereafter came orangey yellow bright LEDs. Perhaps you have yourself seen the slow evolution of traffic lights over the past few decades, gradually to include all three basic colors in LEDs. But now we are left with a problem of blue LEDs. We once again go back to the late 1960s at RCA, the hotbed of optoelectronic research at the time. Red LEDs existed, and yellow and green LEDs were just beginning to appear. A young research scientist named Herbert Maruska at RCA's laboratories in West Windsor, a township in central New Jersey, was involved with LED work. The laboratory leader, James Teachin, came to Maruska in May 1968 and suggested he try to make a blue LED with gallium nitride. Again, this is a 3-5 material, for nitrogen is in the group 5 column of the periodic table. The RCA lab chose to fabricate this gallium nitride semiconductor with an epitaxy method such as I described earlier. Here, they used hot hydrogen chloride with hot gallium metal to make gallium chloride, then reacted that with ammonia, NH3, to grow the gallium nitride layer. They grew the gallium nitride on a flat piece of sapphire, which is aluminum oxide. Teachin and Maruska published their method of growing gallium nitride in November 1969. Maruska went off to get his doctorate at Stanford University, but the lab kept working on gallium nitride as a possible LED. Recall that LEDs work at the junction between a negatively or n-doped material and a positively or p-doped material. RCA could only grow n-doped gallium nitride and gave up trying for p-doped gallium nitride after a couple of years. They changed tactics and decided to try another structure called metal insulator semiconductor on gallium nitride. This method makes a kind of sandwich of transparent indium metal on the bottom, N-type gallium nitride semiconductor in the middle, plus a top layer of zinc-doped gallium nitride. They could make a green LED this way. Maruska, a graduate student but still an RCA employee, changed the zinc to magnesium as the dopant for the top layer. It worked by 1972 and glowed blue. The amount of light was weak, but it existed. But now mismanagement at RCA appeared, which, just like the problem of developing liquid crystal displays, killed the LED project by 1974. David Sarnoff, the originator of the wall TV idea, died in 1971, and Robert, his son, was only interested in competing with the computer firm IBM and not on Gee Whiz electronic parts. So the idea of and research on blue LEDs went away. Or did they? We move to Japan, a hotbed of semiconductor and electronics research in the 1970s and 1980s. At this time, researchers realized a major problem to getting the right kind of blue-emitting material, that is, gallium nitride, was the lattice mismatch problem between the substrate and upper layer. The difference is a whopping 16% in atom distances between sapphire and gallium nitride, and a defect density of a billion per square centimeter. Obviously, most scientists shied away from this seemingly insurmountable problem. Three researchers at Nagoya University, S. Yoshida, S. Misawa, and S. Gonda, resolved the problem in growing gallium nitride on top of sapphire by creating an intermediate layer, aluminum nitride, in between the two, and published their results in March 1983 in the journal Applied Physics Letters. 3 years later, in the same journal, Hiroshi Amano, N. Sawaki, Isamu Akasaki, and Y. Toyoda published another advance. This time, they were able to grow gallium nitride on this intermediate layer, but the gallium nitride top layer was nice and smooth, indicating no cracking or major defects. They could do this because they added a second flow of gas to the hot sapphire surface. But there was still the lingering P-type gallium nitride problem. How do you make that?
We'll be right back.
Hi, and welcome to Hiss and Tell, a cat podcast where we delve deep into the fascinating world of feline behavior with your host, me, Christina Wilson, a professional animal behaviorist. Each episode features insightful discussions with leading veterinarians, dedicated researchers and scientists, experts in cat behavior and training, and so much more. Join me as we decode the complexities of pet loss, unravel the mysteries of feline health and behavior, and discover the latest research findings. I'll meet you at Hiss and Tell.
In April 1988, Shuji Nakamura from the company Nichia Chemicals came to the University of Florida as a visiting researcher, learning how to use metal organic vapor deposition. He had a master's degree but no doctorate, and people there treated him like a technician instead of a researcher, which annoyed him. He went back to Japan a year later, determined to get a doctorate, noticing that lots of people were interested in the easy zinc selenide LED idea, but few in the depressingly hard gallium nitride problem. Back at Nagoya University, Amano, Masahiro Kito, Kazumasa Hiramatsu, and Akasaki, 3 years later, began to see progress on gallium nitride in an article they published in 1989 in the Japanese Journal of Applied Physics. They took the well-known magnesium-doped gallium nitride and zapped it with low-energy electrons, very like the surface analysis technique low-energy electron diffraction I mentioned some episodes ago. They could make small islands of electrically conductive P-type gallium nitride on the regular N-type gallium nitride. Why this happened wasn't immediately obvious, but Shuji Nakamura worked on the question, and by 1992 figured out what was going on. To deposit gallium nitride, you use ammonia gas, NH3, as the source of the nitrogen atoms. near the hot surface, the ammonia breaks up into nitrogen atoms and hydrogen atoms, and people assumed that the hydrogen just goes away. But no, the magnesium atoms in the doped gallium nitride react with the hot hydrogen atoms to make complexes. This prevents the magnesium from being an electron acceptor and prevents P-type material from forming. You have to remove the hydrogen so the magnesium atoms can do their job. The electron beam that Amano and friends used heated up areas of the magnesium-hydrogen-bearing area and kicked off the hydrogen atoms, making P-type islands of gallium nitride. The founder of Nichia, Nobuo Nogawa, was all into this idea, but he stepped down in 1989, and his son Eiji thought the project too expensive. And, like the RCA fiasco nearly 15 years earlier, tried to shut it down. Apparently, Nakamura was so passionate about developing gallium nitride for blue LEDs that he threatened to resign his post at Nichia Chemicals if they didn't give him the resources. A threat that worked. So Nakamura worked on it during his spare time at Nichia Chemicals. Nakamura then decided to heat up the entire magnesium-doped gallium nitride to over 400 degrees C with no ammonia gas at all. As a substitute, you could try plain old nitrogen gas or regular air. And this worked, kicking out the renegade hydrogen atoms from the magnesium and making a complete P-type gallium nitride. In the meantime, though, Amano and buddies' islands of P-type gallium nitride were found to have some short-wavelength LED characteristics. They emitted light at 365 nanometers, a wavelength of ultraviolet that is very faintly detectable to the human eye as a bluish-white color. But this really wasn't a true blue LED yet suitable for color televisions. Nakamura used his method of heating up the gallium nitride to remove the bad hydrogen atoms to fabricate his own true blue LED by 1993, 1,000 times brighter than the weak blue LEDs from RCA and others, just as Amano and Akasaki at Nagoya presented their version of a working blue LED. Nakamura's blue emitted at 440 nanometers. Throughout the 1990s, they improved their fabrication methods to get a brighter, more reliable blue LED. The three won the Nobel Prize in Physics for their blue LEDs in 2014. Nakamura then wanted more efficient blue LEDs that could emit more light. He incorporated layers of indium gallium nitride into the LEDs. This was technically challenging, but eventually he succeeded by 1994. Oddly, and it's still not clear why, these layers of indium gallium nitride have much higher levels of defects than common sense seems to allow. The next step in blue LEDs was commercialization. Nichia Chemicals began the process and was selling them by 1994. The new blue LEDs were so popular that revenues quadrupled and 60% of the income was directly from the blue LEDs. By 1999, Nakamura resigned from Nichia and took a professorship at the University of California in Santa Barbara. A couple of years later, he sued Nichia for revenues, bonuses, and promotions he argued he deserved, and eventually settled for about $8.1 million, which only covered his legal expenses, but was the largest payout by a Japanese firm to an employee ever. So now we have the three primary color LEDs able to create a fully solid-state wall television set only half a century after Sarnoff first got the idea. But there is more to the LED story in the 1990s, the first white LEDs. Once again, there are technical difficulties to leap over. The major one is that you cannot merely combine a red, a green, and a blue LED because their outputs are so narrowband that you get a distorted sense of colors when viewing objects under such light. Rather, you need some kind of wider band of emission among all the LEDs to give a normal color range. Yet, the first white LEDs began to appear in the mid-1990s using a very different method of light production. This method, pioneered by other engineers at Nichia Chemicals, used a blue LED, but covered with a partially absorbing phosphor that took in some of the blue light and re-emitted it as a wideband yellowish color. The phosphor in this case is cerium-doped yttrium aluminum garnet. That is a crystal made of the metals yttrium and aluminum, plus oxygen to make an oxide. The whole thing is doped with a bit of cerium metal. When you shine blue, ultraviolet, or X-rays on this crystal, it glows yellow. It turns out that the blue LED combined with the complementary yellow color of the garnet glow makes a vaguely whitish LED. The color is clearly a bit off from what we might call normal white, but it does strike you as whitish, if a bit unpleasant, because there is no red included. These were the first white LEDs to be sold, with an efficiency of 5 lumens per watt of input electrical power. With all these advancements, LEDs were still not ready to be used for actual interior illumination. Incandescent bulbs have an efficiency of around 15 lumens per watt. Compact fluorescent bulbs are around 60 lumens per watt, and linear fluorescent tubes are roughly 80 lumens per watt. Such developments will have to wait for the 21st century. In the meantime, by the late 90s, one of the first uses for these white LEDs was as illumination inside refrigerators with glass doors on the front, such as you might see in a supermarket. These white LEDs produced a lot less heat even than fluorescent bulbs, so the refrigeration unit didn't have to work so hard to keep the food items chilled. In our next episode, we celebrate the 100th episode of this podcast. So I have prepared a special extended discussion on an invention that permeates our lives but came to fruition in the 1990s, the lithium battery. Until then, brave the elements. Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.